Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Sri Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. This chapter deals with Nitya Karma, which is actually the eternal karma, that is bhakti, in relation to society. So this becomes a topic because many of the devotees seem to ignore the society. They give up society completely. This, of course, was so in India for the renunciates. They just renounced all signs of the varnashram system, so they weren't even sannyasis or anything, and they weren't grihasthas, they weren't vanaprasthas, they had no varna at all. So, but most devotees don't do that, so how do they relate to society, the rest of society? That problem doesn't arise so much in the Western world because they don't have the same social system that is varnashram or the remnants of varnashram. Nevertheless, they do have a society, so still devotees have to relate to other persons in the world, even for preaching, but of course they also have to relate with parents and family members and everyone else who may not be devotees. So in any case, the subject is important and should be analyzed. So the regular society in India was governed by Dharma. And Manu, of course, is one of the main authors who set up the rules for that varnashram system in Manu Smriti. So here, for instance, we have a list of 10 qualities of Dharma: patience, forgiveness, mental control, not stealing, cleanliness, sense control, intelligence, knowledge, truthfulness, absence of anger. So he gives these as 10 good qualities you should have, aspects of Dharma. And I think everyone in the world can agree with that. Not only people in India, but around the world, they'll also agree with this type of these list of qualities. So some of these qualities are in relation to the self. Some are in relation to other people. For instance, we have patience, mental control, cleanliness, sense control, intelligence, and knowledge. So that's something I cultivate myself, and it gives benefit to me. Then we have qualities in relation to others. So we got forgiveness, not stealing from others, truthfulness in relation to others, telling the truth, and not having anger in relation to others. So these are some of the qualities which are necessary for a human being in a regular society. But we see here that worship of the Lord is not included here. So these are the main qualities of Dharma, but worship of the Lord is not there, so something is actually missing. So this is not the ultimate Dharma. This is the Dharma for people who have no belief in God or whatever. So it's not a very complete list, finally. So if we can follow all these other principles, but we don't have faith and worship of the Lord, it's actually incomplete. So the principle is that though we do have a varnashram system, it's incomplete unless there is also some bhakti within that society. It may not be a great amount, but all the people should have some familiarity with the existence of the Lord and agree to worship the Lord. This is just a quote from the Vishnu Dharmottara. It is auspicious to live even 5 days as a devotee of Vishnu, and not auspicious to live for 1,000 kalpas without bhakti to Vishnu. So we have many extreme statements like this to show the importance of bhakti in comparison with any other system or any other social arrangement. Huh? So we do have different types of devotees and different types of bhakti. So the first is called the Kanishta. The Kanishta is a term which not only applies to devotees, it can be Kanishta anything, which means very junior or the lowest in a category, the youngest. Like we have the Kanishta finger, the little finger. Yeah? So that's, it's considered the lowest group or the minor group. So those who are Kanishtas are not very advanced in devotional service. So they take support of the path of bhakti, and therefore they're called devotees or bhaktas. But at the same time, they're not considered to be real bhaktas. Sometimes they're called Vaishnava Praya, which means almost a Vaishnava. So they're kind of classed as Vaishnavas, kind of on a borderline. Of course, it doesn't appear like that in one sense when we see this definition from the 11th canto of Bhagavatam. So here it says, the devotee who faithfully engages in the worship of the deity in the temple, but does not behave properly toward other devotees or people in general, is called an unrefined devotee or a prakrita bhakta. So this is the Kanishta. So the good point is he worships the Lord with faith. So in other words, he does have genuine faith in the Supreme Lord, and he worships the deity form or respects that form and goes to the temple and offers things, etc. The negative point here is he does not respect the devotees or even people in general. So in other words, his relationship to society in general and to devotees is completely different from his worship of the Lord. No respect. So this person is called half a devotee, so to speak, Vaishnava Praya. Which means that recognition of the devotees is a very important element of being a real devotee. If we don't do that, then we're not considered to be a real Vaishnava or half a Vaishnava. So faith in the Lord is not enough. We need more than that. So that's the definition of a Kanishta. So he's half a devotee, but this means that actually he can, if he stays like this, he cannot really attain prema. So in other words, he loses the ultimate goal. He's also considered to be a materialistic devotee. So he's considered a devotee because he has the faith. But if one doesn't respect and worship the devotees, then that is very problematic. And we don't call that pure bhakti. Bhakti cannot develop properly if we don't have a relationship with devotees of the Lord. Of course, it's not just association in the sense of being in a big crowd with people. That's not what we call by respecting the devotees. The real respect for the devotee is we actually understand the importance of devotees and we get knowledge from them. So just to come to a big festival when there's a lot of devotees there, say, okay, I respect devotees, that's not enough. We actually have to gain some knowledge from them. So, this Kanishta devotee is not at the stage of pure bhakti, so he's not called a pure devotee or a real devotee of the Lord. And the reason is he does not have proper knowledge. He cannot distinguish philosophically even what to speak of other things, even the philosophical aspects of the Vaishnava teachings. It is very important, therefore, that we understand what it is when we say we have faith in the Lord. So the Kanishta has faith in a deity. He sees a temple and there's a form there, and he has, I accept him as Supreme Lord, and I'll offer everything, offer objects to him. But who is that Lord, actually? material, spiritual, what? We don't know. Who are we offering to the Lord? Are we material bodies and we're offering to a material object? So there's no real clarity about the nature of the jiva or the atma not being the material body, and the spiritual, the Lord having a spiritual form, not a material form. These topics are not quite understood by the Kanishtha, but very important in order to advance in devotional service. If you don't understand the difference between matter and spirit, and the difference between jiva and Supreme Lord, we can't advance in devotional service. Not in a pure way. So, therefore, we have to have that knowledge, which we call sambandha gyan, knowledge of the Lord, knowledge of the jiva, knowledge of prakriti, knowledge of their relationships. And if we do that, then we can be called a real devotee. So, to get that knowledge, we have to respect the devotees. We have to get that knowledge from the devotees. So, not only should we have faith in the deity, we have to have faith in the devotees. So, we call that people do worship the deity, and they may give nice respect to the deity, but they don't have the proper understanding of exactly who is the Supreme Lord and who is the jiva and why I'm worshipping even. So that is a type of faith which is passable, it's good, it's not hostile or anything, it's called faith or shraddha. But it's different from the faith of a true Vaishnava. So it's called lokika shraddha, or customary faith, or traditional faith. So this is also the faith that most people in the material world have if they're religious, if they go to church or whatever. They just have a customary faith. Yeah, God's there, whatever, pray to God, whatever, but they don't really think too much about, you know, difference in matter and spirit and what is the ultimate goal, etc. That's called customary faith or traditional faith only. Nothing wrong with it, but it's not really clear. So therefore, you can't really get to the highest level with that type of faith. So we have to associate with the devotees who know about pure bhakti and who are practicing pure bhakti. And then we can come to this stage of madhyama. So madhyama means middle. He's not the highest, he's not the lowest. So the lowest was called almost a Vaishnava, not quite a Vaishnava, but he had lokika shraddha, traditional faith. So that's his good qualification. His bad qualification is he doesn't know too much about the nature of the Lord and the jiva. So the madhyama devotee has four characteristics. He offers his love to the Supreme Lord. So in other words, he likes the Kanishtha, he worships the Lord and respects the Lord. But he's friendly with all the devotees of the Lord. He understands the value of the devotees of the Lord. He shows mercy to the ignorant people who are not envious. They're innocent. And he disregards those who are envious. So we found that the Kanishtha worshipped the Lord and respected the Lord in the temple. He didn't respect the devotees, and he didn't give regard even for anybody else. He doesn't really care about anybody else. But the Madhyamadhikari, he shows mercy to the ignorant people who are not envious. So that's a big difference. And he is friendly with all the other devotees. So this is a necessary step. If one is a Madhyama, he's called a real Vaishnava, not a Vaishnava Praya, not an almost a Vaishnava, he's an actual Vaishnava. So this is a very important step to take. One can do other activities as long as they don't contradict this principle of bhakti. So the Madhyama is superior because he has that knowledge, Sambandha Gyan, which the Kunishtha does not have. That's his quality that puts him in this position. We found that the Kanishtha was in a minor position because he didn't really have knowledge of anything around the Supreme Lord, etc., other than the faith. So here we have faith in the Supreme Lord and knowledge, precise knowledge from the scriptures to back it up. And that knowledge comes from devotees. So this bhakti of the Madhyama is pure bhakti. We saw in Nectar Devotion the basic definition of pure bhakti was given. Anya abhilashita shunya jnana karma dinavratam anukulyena krishna anusilanam bhakti uttama. So uttama bhakti, the sadhana bhakti that we call uttama bhakti or pure bhakti in sadhana, is the madhyamadhikari's bhakti, which means that the Kanishtha is not doing pure bhakti. It's mixed. So it's only the Madhyam Adhikari who's doing the pure bhakti. So this bhakti is the beginning. This is sadhana bhakti as we know it. And it's the Madhyam Adhikari who's doing this. When he does this, it progresses to bhava and then to prema. So of course, as the Madhyam Adhikari progresses, eventually when he gets into bhava and prema, then it's not, he's no longer called a Madhyam Adhikari, he's called the Uttam Adhikari. So we have these three types of devotee: the Kanishtha, Madhyama, and Uttama. The Kanishtha actually is not even included really in sadhana bhakti as we know it. He's not part of this definition here. So therefore, he's the Vaishnava Praya. He's not up to the level of real pure bhakti. It's the Madhyamadhikari who has pure bhakti and is doing sadhana. And then he progresses through bhava and prema and becomes uttama. So this, therefore, the Madhyamadhikari is a very important stage, because this is the stage we do pure bhakti. And only if you do this type of bhakti, you get to the prema. You have sadhana, bhava, prema. If you do the other bhakti of the Kanishtha and you don't get up to Madhyama, then you cannot get the bhava and prema. It goes in a different direction. So therefore, if a Kanishtha is there, he has to get the mercy of the Madhyamas to rise up to the Madhyama platform. Then he can go sadhana, bhava, prema. But if he's just doing his Kanishtha work, then he's not even on the level of sadhana, of pure bhakti. So therefore, this is the Madhyam Adhikari stage is the important stage for the devotees. It's also a very broad stage. It continues for a long time, even into bhava. So from the beginning of our sadhana into bhava, we have this Madhyam Adhikari stage. So it's a very long stage comparatively to other stages, but very important. So the Madhyam Adhikari, he worships the Lord. That was the one that was the first item. He worships the Lord. How does he do that? According to this, he does pure bhakti, which means the Kanishtha is not doing this pure bhakti. He's worshiping the Lord and doesn't quite know what. So that means he has some desire this way, some desire that way. Very vague. So the Madhyama, he actually knows when he's worshiping how to worship. Anya abhilashita shunya. So he worships the Lord, and he gives instructions to the innocent people. They were ignorant and innocent. So the Kanishtha Adhikaris are among these innocent people. They're not opposed to the Lord because they do have this traditional faith or Laukika Shraddha. So they're somewhat favorable, but of course they're ignorant. So therefore, the Madhyam Adhikaris can preach to the Kanishtas and give them great benefit. And through that, the Kanishtas can rise to the Madhyama platform. One may have other people who are not practicing even up the Kanishtha stage, they're not even doing bhakti. But they may also be innocent. They may not have hatred of the Lord or anything. So we can do something for those people as well. So the innocent people, including the Kanishtas, will have a lot of bad ideas, a lot of their own independent thinking. They may have faith in karmakanda, some inclination to jnana and impersonalism, worship of the deity with other desires. They may have faith in yoga. They may have indifference to associating with devotees, which is favorable for the advancement. They may be overly attached to the varnashram system. So these are all things which can act as obstacles for them. And if they don't get rid of these ideas, then they can't really advance to pure bhakti or madhyama stage. So, if they get the association of devotees, they can destroy all these misconceptions. And finally, they can progress towards the madhyama stage. So it's very necessary for the Kanishtha to get some mercy from the madhyama and accept the instructions. Then he can progress to the madhyama stage himself. If he doesn't get the mercy of madhyama adhikaris, who's he going to get mercy from? Karmis, jnanis, or somebody else? Then he'll go off in another direction. So the only way he can get to the madhyama platform is from the other madhyamas who are preaching to him. Kanishtha is called a material Vaishnava. But he's called a Vaishnava, at least, because he's not contaminated with Mayavad concepts of merging, etc. So that makes him a kind of a Vaishnava. That's his good quality. So by association with the devotees, then he can progress. If he's too contaminated with Mayavad concepts, then really cannot progress. So I mentioned previously that there's what is called the false Vaishnava, or they look like Vaishnavas, but actually, and they may worship deities of Vishnu or Krishna, and they may have Vaishnava mantras, Vishnu mantras or Krishna mantras or whatever, and they may take diksha, etc. But their whole idea is something completely different. They want to use the deity to purify themselves and then merge in Brahman. So that's not real Vaishnavism at all. So the Kanishtha Adhikari is not that type of person. He hasn't got that negative idea of the form of the Lord being false. So that's his good quality, at least. So this Madhyama Adhikari also avoids the haters, those who hate the Lord, or they have hatred. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's five types of hatred, and we have to avoid people that have these types of hatred. So one, of course, is lack of faith in the Lord. We reject the idea of a Supreme Lord. So we have to avoid those persons. Another is the Lord is some natural Shakti. This is the Karma Mimamsa philosophers. They say that you do worship of devatas and you do yajnas, and then you get a result of that due to some natural Shakti called Apurva, and then you get elevated to Svargaloka. It's nothing to do with the Lord. Or if it is, it's called the Lord is of Shakti, that's all. That's all. It's nothing more than that. Another is to not accept the form of the Lord. That means you accept something supreme, but it's not Bhagavan. It's not even Paramatma. So in other words, it's impersonalism, which could be Mayavad also. So these are considered to be haters of the Lord also. So we don't preach to those persons, impersonalists. Huh? Thinking that the jiva is not eternally dependent on the Lord. In other words, we don't accept the jiva as Nitya Krishna Das, eternally the servant of the Lord. Huh? So this indicates that you can it's very close to the Mayavad philosophy, where the jiva actually, if he gets rid of ignorance, he becomes the Lord. So the idea of being a jiva is a false conception of Brahman. And we remove ignorance, then the jiva realizes he is Brahman, and then there's no jiva. So we have to accept that the jiva is an eternal particle, completely separate from the Lord. That way we can have bhakti in the spiritual world, otherwise the bhakti would disappear if the jiva was not eternally servant of the Lord. So people that don't accept this idea of this jiva being different from the Lord and dependent on the Lord, then they're to be avoided. Other haters are people who are devoid of mercy. That means it's people who are in generally violent people. They don't respect any living entities. So these people are haters. They have to be avoided also. So these are the different types of people, but we can see among them there is low-class people who are very cruel in their conduct, and then we have people, the more or less the impersonalists. They either want the jiva to merge into Brahman, they don't have a faith in the form of the Lord, or they may think that the Lord is just a material shakti of some sort. So these are the types of people to be avoided, or the atheists, complete atheists. So therefore, one has to avoid these persons. We avoid them. So that's why we say, don't preach to the faithless persons. Basically, it means these persons. Bhaktivinoda, of course, is very generous. So we don't associate with them for spiritual matters. He says, we can deal with them on a normal human level. Therefore, if the person's in danger or he's suffering for some reason, we can help him to get rid of his suffering. In this way, the householder devotees should act. They're not completely indifferent to everybody in the material world. So they'll help another person if they see them suffering. In this way, it's not that we completely avoid such people. We can be compassionate to them on a material level, so to speak. Just like other people in the material world, they show compassion, so we also show that type of compassion. What we don't do is we don't associate with them spiritually. We don't give them spiritual instructions, and we don't ask them for any spiritual advice. So we don't have spiritual association with them. So we avoid them in that sense. We're on a spiritual level. As far as ordinary dealings, we should deal with them, and like everybody else deals with these people. So how does the Madhyama act in relation to those who are innocent? So he also relates a little bit differently to different types of people. He has to be intelligent enough not to preach to everybody the same way or deal with everybody the same way as when he's preaching to them or helping them understand Krishna consciousness. There people are at different levels. Some have more ignorance and less sincerity. Some have a little bit of intelligence and knowledge and more sincerity. So we can preach to them in different ways. And if they show, some may have a little bit of hatred, so then these ones we have to avoid. So the Madhyama Adhikari has to be intelligent enough to very carefully judge the nature of people he's preaching to. Of course, he avoids those who he knows are the haters, and then he tries to pick the innocent people. And among those, then, there are various grades of ignorance and lack of sincerity, more knowledge, etc. Okay, so in this way he deals with the people in this material world. Now, the Uttama, This means the highest. Uttama means topmost. So he sees everything from the position of prema. And a person in prema bhakti, his vision is quite different from everybody else's vision. He sees everything in terms of prema, even the material world. So he sees even the demons in terms of prema, which is difficult for us to understand. So the Madhyamadhikari, he avoids the demons, he avoids the haters. The Uttamadhikari sees the even these people as part of Krishna's pastimes in prema. So that is difficult for us to understand, because we haven't got prema, so we don't have that vision. So everything that arises for him is a transformation of prema only and nothing else. So this person acts quite differently from the Madhyama. He does not make distinctions of the haters, those who are innocent, those who are devotees, etc. Of course, he does distinguish himself from the Supreme Lord. It's not that he disrespects the devotees also, he also gives respect to the devotees, but he doesn't make this distinction between devotee and non-devotee. So, therefore, we don't find these different types of deities. Everything's in terms of prema. We cannot expect that person on this level to act in the same way as the Madhyama. We can't, if we project the standards that we have as a Madhyama on the Uttama, this is also incorrect. We may criticize him for not doing like we're doing, so we can't do that. So this state, of course, of being Uttama is very, very rare. Now, though we would say he doesn't preach anymore, that's the idea. There are cases where even the Uttama does preaching work. So Jiva Goswami gives the example of Narada Muni. He's in prema, but he also preaches. So it's not that they don't preach, but that's also very rare among the Uttamas. The other aspect of the Madhyama is his relationship with devotees. Yeah, he worships the Lord with pure bhakti, anyabhilashita sunya. He avoids the haters completely. Like that. He preaches to the innocent people, including the kanishtas. And he relates to the devotees in a very nice way. So the kanishta does not serve devotees, doesn't recognize devotees. The uttama doesn't distinguish between devotee and non-devotee. So it's the Madhyamadhikari who is very much into the respect and service to the devotees. So he, as I said, he has to be a little intelligent to distinguish different types of devotees. He distinguishes different types of kanishtas or innocent people. And then among other devotees who are Madhyamas, he can also make distinctions. So previously we had an explanation. A devotee is one who chants once the name of the Lord purely, one who chants the name of the Lord purely constantly or continuously, and one who inspires other people to chant purely. These are the three levels of devotees. So the Madhyama serves these type of devotees, but of course ultimately he gives the most respect to the highest of these. So, the Kanishta, he worships the Lord with faith in the temple, but he does not really understand the nature of pure bhakti, of what bhakti really is. So, he accepts that deity form, that's good, and he worships that form, and he may even hear, chant, remember, and do other devotional activities like Madhyama also does. However, when he's doing these activities, he is likely to be affected by the gunas. So therefore, The activities of hearing and chanting, etc., are affected by the gunas. So they're called gona as a result. So it also means secondary. Yeah? So though he may do these other activities as secondary activities, such as hearing and chanting, his main action is worshipping the deity. And that's the definition given of the Kanishta. He worships the deity in the temple with faith. So that's his main activity. He can do the other activities of hearing and chanting and other, but it's all more or less contaminated by the gunas, and they're done secondarily only. So this is the nature of the bhakti of the Kanishta. So if one becomes a Madhyama, then chanting and hearing are no longer mixed with the gunas. He doesn't have material desires or desires for liberation or anything in relation to his activities of hearing and chanting. So therefore he can come to the Madhyama stage. Other aspects, of course, are no contamination of karma and gan, only desiring bhakti. This is anyabhilashita shunya. When he serves devotees, he understands this is very special. It's different from serving other guests. So when he understands who are the real devotees, that is other madhyamas, etc., and serves them, then he's at the madhyama level. Okay. So, the Kanishta, how does he start worshipping the deity with faith? Of some sort. Of course, it's not pure faith, as we know. It's Laukika Shraddha. So, this may arise by association with devotees, accidentally, so to speak, or unintentional. Then, over many lifetimes, he gets some mercy from devotees, and then he develops this traditional faith. That's not enough. He has to serve and respect the devotees. He has to get that knowledge. Therefore, as long as he doesn't get that mercy and serve the devotees, he remains at that Kanishta level and he cannot progress. So when he associates with devotees, hears about the Lord, etc., gets knowledge of scripture, and understands the nature of the Lord, the Lord's name, the deity forms, in his hearing and chanting, which are beyond the gunas, he gets some undergyan. Then he can advance. Then he can become Madhyamadhikari. So it's very necessary that he gets the mercy of the Madhyamadhikari to advance to the Madhyama stage. So we saw that the Kanishta, his main activity was worshipping in the temple with some sort of faith, but it was Laukika Shraddha, and he may do the other activities of bhakti in a secondary way, which are also not pure. So what does the Madhyama do? He worships the Lord in the temple like the Kanishta, but it's with pure bhakti. This anyabhilashita shunya definition. No desire for material benefits or desire for liberation. He associates with the devotees. He's possessive of the devotees. He worships them. Regards them as places of pilgrimage. Gives mercy to the ignorant. And he's indifferent to the malicious, to the haters. These are the primary qualities. And what is he? His goal is achieving prema by that sadhana. These are the qualities of the Madhyama. It's all related to pure bhakti. What are the secondary activities of the Madhyama? We have the primary activity. Secondary activities is what he does for a living. The rest of us, to support his material body, and how he lives in this world. That's secondary aspects. But these are also related to his devotional service. Udamata Uttama Adhikari. So really the Uttamadhikari is beyond the material world. So the only secondary activities for him are whatever, because he has a body, it must act in the material world. He's not really concerned about it, but those are his secondary activities. So ultimately, these activities of the material body are also connected to prema beyond the guna. So really, he doesn't have any secondary activities. It's all, everything is related to the Lord. So the idea here is that bhakti is very special, and why it is special is actually it's independent. It does not depend on any other process for its progress, for its cause, and for attaining the goal. Bhakti produces bhakti. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it does not depend on any good quality. So in Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami says developing good qualities is not an anga of bhakti. It's not part of the cultivation of bhakti, developing good qualities. Sometimes we think that you have to develop good qualities to be a good devotee, but actually he says we're not cultivating good qualities as part of our bhakti. We're cultivating devotion to the Lord. Everything else is secondarily manifested as a result of that. So we don't cultivate good qualities as a separate type of activity. So even humility and compassion, they're not separate qualities from bhakti. We don't cultivate those things separately. They're part of bhakti itself, and they develop in relation to the Supreme Lord. What is forgiveness? Previously, in one of the qualities of dharma of Manu, when he listed 10 qualities there of dharma, then one of them is forgiveness. Forgiveness, according to Bhaktivedanta Thakur, says that's between compassion and humility. Humility is I feel low. So therefore we say, how can I punish another person? And we combine that with compassion, it becomes forgiveness. So we forgive the other person. In this way, forgiveness is also included within bhakti. When we accept bhakti, we accept Krishna, the Supreme Lord, with his form, qualities, activities, as real. It's not some imaginary thing. The jiva is real, not imaginary. Mayavadi say jiva is not false, not real. And we accept the jiva's eternal servant of the Lord. These are three basic things we accept. This is our sambandhagyan. Dwelling in the material world, it's also real. It's not an illusion. Mayavadi say our existence here is illusion. We say, no, it's real. We can't deny the fact that we are in the material world and we're in ignorance. So this is, our illusion is also real in this material world. So, because the jiva is real, and Supreme Lord is real, and the jiva is an eternal servant of Krishna, then our relationship with Krishna and devotion is also real. And in that real relationship of bhakti, we have humility, compassion, forgiveness, etc. All this is real. Fine. Any question there?
Basically, they're very rare to be on the level to Mahadikari. Uttamadhikari.
Yeah.
It would be very rare to be seen in this world. So the majority would be at least in the Vaishnava world would be Madhumati Kari.
Yeah. We can say all devotees who actually do have association with other devotees and they're reading Bhagavad Gita and they're following a sampradaya, they must be Madhyamas.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Madhyamati Kari, what's like the highest level one could achieve through practice of bhakti on the Madhyam level? Sometimes I've heard like the second stage of chanting is Namabhas, and that can take you up to the gates of Vaikuntha. So is that the level of high level of Madhyam? I mean, are there three stages of chanting?
Yeah. So actually Namabhas is, we can say Namabhas is Kanishta.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Namabhas means we don't know about, we have ignorance and we have anartas. So the ignorance, we don't know who the Lord is, in other words, we don't have Sambandhagyan. So that's Namabhas.
Well, obviously there's different levels within that category of Namabhas.
Yeah, but then when pure, there's also levels. So in pure bhakti, we're going through Bhajana Kriya, Anartha Navritti, Nishtaruchi, Asakti Bhava. So that's all within Madhyama stage and pure bhakti. Yeah? And all the way up to prema. So the Madhyama is up into Bhava, and then we get Uttama in later Bhava and Prema. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And all that's pure bhakti from the you know, our sadhana. So that's all Madhyamadikari. But so Madhyamadikari has many subdivisions, we can say, within it, because we're going from the very beginning stages with faith in pure bhakti and then practicing pure bhakti, associated with devotees, etc., and then go through Anartha Vritti, etc. So that's all part of pure bhakti, mm-hmm. and it's all Madhyama stage. Well, they don't want liberation. So technically, if Ajamil, by accidentally chanting, he got up to liberation in one sense, so that obviously the devotees are beyond that already, because they're intentionally chanting, and hopefully they're not doing any offenses.
So as is from devotees, I mean, hopefully we're all desiring liberation, so does that make us still Madhumati Kari?
If they desire liberation?
We're a practice of bhakti. A goal is, of course, it's Krishna praying, but it's also liberation is there as well.
Well, that's automatically included in it. We get out of the material world, we go to Goloka, so we're liberated in that sense. So when I say we don't want liberation, that's, and we don't want impersonal liberation stopping there and emerging in the personal Brahman.
So for the very Vaishnava of design, Krishna praying, mm-hmm. so that's above that having that desire, we're not in the category of Madhumati Kari. I'm trying to understand that you're saying Madhumati Kari is I'm trying to just slot it in. But like the average or the you know, the ISKCON devotee desiring Krishna praying,
yeah.
Does that mean we're still in the Madhumati Kari level?
Yeah, well, everyone who's following this process of Rupa Goswami, Ani Avalasya Shunigan Kamriya Avartam, which hopefully we are. We're not desiring, you know, going to Svargaloka or getting a personal Brahman. We're heading, so that, yeah, that's what I could say is all Madhyamadikari.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, in Gita, we hear the four types of pious persons who approach Krishna.
Yeah.
So, with
we can say they're more or less Kanishtas. At least the first two are, let's say, materially like Karma Mr. Bhakti or something, and the next ones are Gyan Mr. Bhakti, perhaps. So they're actually Kanishtas, we can say.
Yeah.
Inquisitive sages.
Inquisitive.
Yeah.
So that's still
Kanishta. Yeah.
Because generally you hear that they're, you know, great saintly persons come
Oh yeah, well your saintly persons could be Karmakandis also. Some of them, you know, like even when Parikshit was speaking, they had a whole people that were a mixed audience there. We have impersonalists, we have jnanis, we got great sages who were bhaktas like Narada Muni, and then we got maybe Karmakandis there also.
And the one who's desiring, like the fourth level of desiring to know about Krishna. That would be beyond, like that being Madhun.
Well, he'd actually have prema, so. But pure bhakti, definitely. It's all pure bhakti. Yeah. Well, actually, this we know that in Nectar Devotion describes five elements as being the most important and powerful. One of them is living in the Holy Dham. So now we say, well, why is living in the Holy Dham? Because nobody can live there except a few people. So why is that? But actually, it is a very powerful influence. So because it's absolute. It's Krishna's place where he was born or when he lived. So it's actually very spiritually powerful, just like a deity is powerful or the holy name is powerful. So, but that's a whole place which is very powerful. So by living there, one can imbibe that devotion very easily. Unfortunately, everybody cannot live there constantly due to material circumstances in this world. So Jiva Goswami says that if you cannot live there, then you can meditate on the place. So we have meditation on the Dham, different verses like that, where you can meditate on the Dham. There's descriptions of the Dham in different places. So we can at least meditate on those places when we're doing our sadhana and whatever like that. The other, of course, if we're going there, then we can do a service as well in the Dham. So that's one of the angas of bhakti also, Dham Seva. We have Shastra Seva, Vaishnava Seva, we have Dham Seva and Tulsi Seva. There's four Sevas mentioned as Angas of Bhakti, so one is Dham Seva. So we can do some sort of service there in the Dham, and it's very powerful also to help us advance in devotional service. And another thing, if we can't go there, at least we can do Tulsi Seva. Tulsi Seva is also very powerful. The Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, and also the example of Mrugari the hunter. Well, he got the mercy of Narada Muni, so he got Kripa City in one sense, but in three or four months, he went from zero to bhava stage in 3 months. But what he was doing, of course, Narada Muni told him, you have to give up your previous occupation and not kill any animals anymore, and stay with your wife and family in a cottage, and don't worry about where the money's coming from, or how you're going to survive, or whatever, it'll happen. So what he did, he sat down there and he had a tulsi tree, so he was chanting in front of the tulsi tree. That was his, part of his sadhana, so he could advance in 3 or 4 months. So worshipping tulsi is also very powerful.
Well, there's two ways
two general ways you could go, according to some devotees. Of course, maybe it's more than that, but for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, one is go directly, just enter into Krishna's pastimes. But that may be in two ways. One, directly in the spiritual world, the other is in another universe. And then you get born into a family of cowherd people and join Krishna's pastime in that universe. Or you can go directly into the spiritual world, either of those two ways. The other way is you could go gradually through Svargaloka, Mahaloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, Brahmaloka, and then go to spiritual world. But that is usually reserved for people that have a little attachment to ashram system, slight attachment. Then they go through that process, they become purified, then they go out. So those who develop real prema, then they would go directly either to another universe where Krishna is having his pastimes, or to Goloka. Those two ways. Not separately, we don't cultivate, there's maybe some courses to try to develop good qualities, so it's not as a separate endeavor, it's part of bhakti.
Yes.
We do it as part of bhakti, and related to Krishna.
But don't we have to be conscious about it anyway?
We have be humble than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree. Definitely we have to be conscious that when we're doing our bhakti, we should have those qualities also. And if they're not there, then we can understand we're not really doing bhakti. Yeah? So if we have bhakti, then these just manifest. And of course, with the development of bhakti, then they become more. Yeah? And they're always in relation to our bhakti and Supreme Lord. They're not like independent qualities. The one we'd say don't cultivate good qualities, it actually means these are the sattvic qualities or the dharmic qualities that we saw that Manu has listed. Yeah? So the qualities are all related to Krishna, so they develop in a little bit different way. So definitely we should look at those qualities and have an ideal of having the qualities, but have it related to Krishna and bhakti, and then it will naturally develop. Okay.
Dwelling on the two ways in which one can expect Godhead. So, First way of prayer, you expect a pure desire that he just wants to be with Krishna. And the second way is, like I said, a scenic route. So, there's.
Yeah, a scenic route.
What comes to mind is two ways to go to a scenic route. First, I think in the Bhagavad Gita it states that when Buddha. I think that Krishna Guru has got the airplane for you, went past all the celestial planets. So.
Yeah.
So, but that was just like in the same body on the way to the pole star. So, scenic route.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, the other route is that if you want to go that way, is it that you have to take birth on the celestial planets, like in the Loka or something, and from there work your way up
to
different births or.
Yeah, that's what we call the krama mukti or gradual liberation. You go upwards and take another body and another body, go higher and higher and higher. So that's for the persons who have a little bit of attachment to karmas and stuff in the material world, so they go that route. Otherwise, you can see it as we see in the case of Gopakumar, for instance. He got a vision of going through everything. He could see everything. He went to Vaikuntha, but he could see going through the material universe. Then he went through the coverings of the universe. He went up, and then he finally went to Vaikuntha that way.
So the first part of that like the scenic route, that's not really sort of viable option unless you're a sort of special nurse to get the special.
Yeah, well, that's just another way. Maybe the Lord will do that. You may have a little desire for curiosity, so the Lord will show it to you. But even that person is qualified for prema, so therefore he's not really interested in it. As Gopakumar also wasn't really interested in it. Yeah. Whereas the other person, he does have a little interest in seeing those things, and maybe experience him. So he goes Krama Mukti, you know, because he got a little bit of desire still. So he goes and experiences the higher planets, and then finally he goes out. So maybe we can continue on with this one then. This is another chapter. This is Bhakti and Itihas, which means history. So there is a challenge that some people say that Bhakti is very recent. It's come out in the last, you know, 500, 600 years when we suddenly get Lord Chaitanya and other saints coming up, even the Vaishnava Acharyas like Ramanuja and Madhva. It's all within the last 1,000 years or so. So before that, the traditional thing was not Bhakti at all. That's the what people claim. So, therefore, in Jiva Dharma, the argument is presented, no, Bhakti is actually eternal. So it's not recent at all. It's the most ancient of all teachings. Huh? So as soon as the Jivas appear in the material world, we have Bhakti. So it's not a recent thing at all. Huh? So when Brahma appeared and the Vedas, he got the instructions of the Vedas, we got Vaishnava Dharma appearing at that time, because Vaishnava Dharma is in the Vedas themselves. So in the Mundaka Upanishad, which is Upanishad or Sruti, which is eternal, among the demigods, Brahma was the first to take birth. He is the creator of this universe and also his protector. To his eldest son, Atharva, he instructed Brahma Vidya, which is the basis of all of the branches of knowledge. The devotees see that Supreme Lord, abode of Vishnu, spread in the sky like the sun at all times. So this is from the Rig Veda, which is also eternal Sruti. It was talking about Vishnu in his supreme abode. Katha Upanishad says, the Lord is not attained by speaking, by intelligence, or by hearing. He is attained by the person whom the Lord chooses. The Lord shows his form to him. So this is directly indicating the form of the Lord. It says tanum, which means the body of the Lord. So the body of the Lord is there, and he chooses who he wants to reveal himself to. So this is an indication of bhakti and the Katha Upanishad, which is one of the major Upanishads. So a very strong statement to show that bhakti is there in the original Vedas. And when Brahma was born, then the Vedas came out of his mouth. So at the very beginning of the universe, we have bhakti. So, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur has indicated in the very beginning, the real dharma is serving the Supreme Lord. And we see in this previous verse that was quoted, if the Lord shows mercy, then he reveals his form to the devotee. So the normal impersonal gyan is not going to manifest anything. It's the Supreme Lord who manifests his form, and it's by his mercy. So therefore, strong statements like that show that the pure Vaishnava Dharma is in the Vedas itself. It may not be fully expanded, but it's there. So therefore, we cannot say that it's a recent thing. So when Mahaprabhu talks about bhakti and prema, etc., it's not some new invention. It's actually there in the Vedas. And though many people think that impersonal jnana and merging in Brahman is the ultimate goal, and this is in the Upanishads, which are part of the Veda, and therefore this is the eternal process, that's actually not true. Because we see in Taittira Upanishad, it says, Raso Vaisaha, the Lord is Rasa. It's not impersonal at all. Rasa means taste. Rasa means, relationship. And we have another verse here from Chandogya Upanishad, also a major Upanishad. Surrendering to the dark blue Lord, Shama, I surrender to his variegated qualities. Surrendering to his qualities, I surrender to him. So we have a mention of Shama. Here's another quote from, I think, Veda, Rig Veda. Apasyam gopam, ani padyamana ma. I saw the cowherd who does not fall from the spiritual world. So we have so many statements from the Vedas to show that bhakti is not recent, but it's in the Vedas itself. So Brahma was a Vaishnava. He meditated and he saw the Lord. And he got instructions from the Lord. Shiva was a Vaishnava. All the Prajapatis were Vaishnavas. Brahma's mental son, Narada, was a Vaishnava. He's a Shaktivesh avatar teaching bhakti. So, and in Kali Yuga, we have great acharyas, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, and Vishnu Swami appearing. And in the western part of India, Nimbarka appeared. And they preached pure Vaishnava Dharma. So through this, half of India was covered by bhakti. And then later, 500 years ago, we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu delivering the people. So, though the Vedas is the root of bhakti, it doesn't manifest fully. We don't see its full expression there. So, Vaishnava Dharma is like a lotus that blossoms gradually. It turns into a bud, opens up a little, and then finally becomes a full flower. So, with Brahma, then we get the little bud coming out. Now, and we see in the second canto of Bhagavatam, the Chatusloki, the four key verses there, the seed verses. That's like the little bud. we find there in those verses, bhakti is there, sadhana is there, prema is there, knowledge of maya, knowledge of the Lord, etc., all there, but it's in very concentrated form, like a little bud. So it got a little bit bigger when the bud got a little bigger when we get Prahlad and others. They explain Navavida Bhakti, nine types of devotional service. And then when we get Vyasadeva, then it begins to blossom, and he writes Puranas and Srimad Bhagavatam. And then the Vaishnavacharyas begin to explain bhakti in greater detail, like Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Vishnu Swami, and then finally Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We get prema fully blossoming. That means that he gives the explanation of all the rasas, and particularly Madhurya rasa. So we get the full blossoming of bhakti at that point. Okay, so this is in this sense the Vaishnava Dharma is there, but it has to manifest gradually. And so with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we get the full manifestation. What did Shankaracharya do? How do we accept him? So we take him as an avatar of Shiva. And Mahaprabhu said we should respect him as an acharya. So though he revealed Mayavad philosophy, we don't accept that philosophy. It's not mentioned in the Vedas. It's borrowed Buddhism, covered Buddhism. So we accept him as devotee of the Lord, but we don't accept the philosophy. So there are many quotes to show from Padma Purana to show that actually he was ordered by the Lord to propagate this philosophy. In order to pacify or stabilize the demonic element, people who are more or less demonic. Another thing covered in this chapter is, do we accept the prasad offered to devatas? Should we accept it? And then we say, no, Vaishnava shouldn't accept it. So then people will criticize, oh, you're so fanatical, you only accept Krishna prasadam, you only accept prasad from devatas and other temples. What is this? Not proper, you know, you're not following Vedas properly. In answer to that, we have this idea that even the yoga scriptures tell the yogis not to accept prasadam of the devatas, only take Vishnu prasadam. So that doesn't mean he doesn't respect the Vedic literatures, or doesn't respect the devatas or whatever. So he only takes those things which are favorable for his own practice. So prasadam of Vishnu is favorable for his meditation, so that's what he should take. We don't take the prasad of devatas because, and we only take the prasad of the Lord because this is the way in which bhakti can develop properly, pure bhakti can develop. Yeah? So we're not disrespecting the devatas, but we're trying to achieve prema. So therefore, we follow the procedure to get to prema, and we take the Vishnu prasad, not the prasad of devatas. Shraddha rites is always often a controversial topic among people. Should we do Shraddha rites? Because they're very complicated and long, and Vaishnavas generally get a little impatient with such things. long ceremonies, which are Karmakanda rites. So, for Karmakanda people, you let them do the Shraddha rites, not like that. So, those who are real Vaishnavas are beyond all of that. So they're not obligated to anybody. They don't have to absolve their debts by doing these Shraddha rites to pitras, etc. And the best solution is to worship the Lord. And the Lord is satisfied, all the devatas, ancestors, everybody else is satisfied. So we can offer the prasadam of the Supreme Lord to the ancestors and pitras and whatever. So then it's actually Vishnu Prasad or Krishna Prasad. So this is the verse of Bhagavatam. One who has given up all varnashramak duties and has taken full shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda, who offers shelter to all, is not a debtor to or servant of the devatas, great sages, ordinary beings, relatives, or pitras. If one is a devotee, one is no longer indebted to anybody else. From the day one has faith in hearing about the Lord and chanting his name, the Vaishnava has qualification. As long as one does not become detached from daily and periodic duties or is not awake in his faith in hearing topics about me, one must perform one's prescribed duties of varnashram. But if one is attached to the Lord and the duties, one can give up those things. Here's another chapter on idols. So this is often a subject by from other religion or topic of other religions. They criticize Indians for worshiping idols. So we have different types of forms. We have the forms of devatas, and then we have the forms of the Supreme Lord. So they're quite different. So some people will say, well, we shouldn't have any forms because they look material, and we should just think of God as being very great. But the answer is that greatness is not the highest quality of God. We need something more remarkable, and that should be the real nature of God. So greatness can cause astonishment, yes, but even being very small can cause astonishment. So Bhagavan, this includes all types of astonishing qualities, not just big or small or whatever. All qualities are there in Bhagavan. So we shouldn't limit Bhagavan to certain descriptions. So we have in the, of course, very famous six qualities of Bhagavan, who is the most powerful. He can also be the smallest, but that's one of his qualities. He's full of all wonderful qualities, the most auspicious, yasa, that's his quality. So he displays his qualities in his leelas, in his pastimes. He's full of beauty, Shri. He has unlimited knowledge, jnana. He has a chitsarupa, a form of, a spiritual form of knowledge beyond matter. And that becomes his deity form. And he's independent of everything, uncontaminated by the material world, vairagya. Okay, so if we imagine a form of Bhagavan, yes, that's not proper, that's material. And we know many people will do that in the material, whether they make any form they want, put it on the wall, or put it in the cupboard and worship it, or like that. Or put it under a tree and worship it. So, we want to worship the eternal form of the Lord, the form described in the scriptures. So, if people are unqualified, definitely they cannot understand what worship of the deity is. Even if he doesn't have a form of the Lord, and so we don't want forms, and he meditates on the Lord in his mind, even he's going to concoct some other form in his mind, and it'll be full of material qualities. Yeah? So, we should rise above that by following the advice of the scriptures and the great sages. So why do we have forms at all? Because it helps cultivate faith. If the person beginning bhakti doesn't have a form, then he gets a little confused and cannot concentrate, and he will give up hope. So great devotees have seen the Lord. The Lord appears before the devotees or internally to the devotee. He's not without form. He has form, but it'll appear only to the qualified person. The devotee who has the realization can convey that to people in the material world to some degree. So we can say that whatever form that becomes is like a reflected form of what he visualizes or he sees in his heart or he sees before him. So this becomes the deity. It's the vision of the realized soul. And then he describes that and makes a form of that. So that's what we have as a deity. So this is not a concocted form at all. So if we do have high qualification, then we'll understand the deity is non-different from the Supreme Lord. If we're Manjim Adhikari, we'll have to mentally think about it and relate the form with the spiritual form. And if we're lower qualification, we look at the form and then it's something material. If the person at the highest level, they see the deity, they will see the actual spiritual form. So, through the practice of bhakti, worshipping the deity forms, then eventually we see that spiritual form. If we do bhakti yoga, we get to bhava stage, and bhava stage, then we can see the Lord. We have a direct experience of the Lord, and we can identify that form that we see with the deity form. Okay, so if we associate with devotees, then we can actually begin to experience the real nature of the deity, and gradually that will develop to such a degree that we can realize the form. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is kind of generous, and he says that all around the world, people want to show gratitude somehow. So they want to worship something and offer something to those forms. So we see around the world people worshiping things and making offerings everywhere in the world. That's a very common feature of all religions and primitive religions also. So people may offer respects to the sun or to the rivers, to the mountains, to animals or whatever. So that's showing some sort of respect and gratitude. But, of course, we should go beyond that develop a real understanding who is the Supreme Lord and show gratitude to the Supreme Lord instead. This is, we can say, a primitive expression of that, of bhakti, often maybe misplaced. So if the people can go beyond that foolish worship and develop bhakti, then they can express their gratitude properly with the worshipping the proper form. Another chapter. Very short, okay. Sadhana and sadhya. Sadhana means practice. Sadhya means the result. Sadhya means the goal. Sadhana means sadhana bhakti. Sadhya means prema. So they look like they're different, but actually they're both bhakti. So bhakti is eternal. It has two forms, as sadhana and as sadhya, but it's actually one thing. So we do bhakti now. When we have prema, we do the same bhakti. It's just that it's done with, we could say, greater realization. So we have other sadhanas. We have karma as a sadhana and jnana as a sadhana. These, of course, are secondary processes. So some people will call this sadhana, but we don't actually accept that as the real sadhana. Some people who see the problems of the material world, they reject the material world, and then they go to try to escape, and they do jnana as a sadhana. And they take shelter of the Jnanakanda scriptures. We have many sadhanas, and then we have many sadhyas. So karma gives its own goal, then we get jnana giving a goal, and then we have bhakti giving a goal. So if we link them all together, finally the goal should be prema. So we don't reject these other processes, but they are, we say, elementary processes leading up to the process of bhakti and finally to prema. When we come to bhakti, we do a sadhana, and we attain prema, which is also bhakti. So sadhana and sadhya, the sadhana and the result are both bhakti. And the other forms are, say, they keep changing. We go from karma to jnana, and then we go to bhakti. So they are temporary, and bhakti is eternal. So therefore, we have liberation praised, but that is, we say, also a step only. It's not the final goal. So we should look for the final goal in scriptures, and finally we see that that is bhakti as sadhana and prema as the sadhya. That's the final pramana. There was a whole topic about where is bhakti in the Vedas, etc., or is it recent or ancient? Here again we get another very famous quote. One should have devotion to Guru as one has for the Lord. To the great souls, the real meaning of the scriptures are revealed. So here we see para-bhakti. We should have bhakti to the Lord like we have bhakti to Guru. And then these meaning of the scriptures are revealed. From Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Atmanam eva priyam upasita. One should worship the Lord as the dearest person. So this is also from the Upanishad Shruti. So we have bhakti in other forms that we call bhakti abhas. So when we mix the bhakti with other elements or combined with other elements, this is what we call bhakti abhas. And then we get different results. If we do pure bhakti, we get prema. If we do bhakti with a mixture of karma, we end up with svarga. So these are bhakti abhas. I think we better end there. Hare Krishna.